Would you have a seat, please? Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to welcome you to this session. My name is Eric Peterson. I'm Senior Vice President here at CSIS, and I also direct the Global Strategy Institute here. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this session entitled Fighting Corruption, the Problem of Business. I know that you're looking forward to moving straight into the comments from our featured speaker, but let me do one or two points of housekeeping. The first is that we have a nice breakfast in the back of the room. I hope you'll avail yourself of that privilege. Also, I'd like to remind you to turn off any noise-emitting devices that you may have so that we can establish continuity. And with that, let me begin by introducing an individual who needs no introduction. Roderick M. Hills is the former chairman of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Here at CSIS, we know him as the program founder, together with his wife Carla, who is a trustee and counselor here at CSIS, in attendance with us also this morning, of the Hills Program on Governance. Rod Hills has been a visiting professor at Harvard University School of Law, distinguished faculty member at Yale University School of Management, a lecturer at Stanford University School of Law. He's also served as a law clerk on the U.S. Supreme Court. He's also served on numerous corporate boards, has extensive responsibility, past and present, with respect to corporations. He's currently the co-chairman of the Committee for Economic Development, the vice chairman of the U.S. ASEAN Business Council, of which he was a founder and former chairman. He also holds an undergraduate degree and JD, both from Stanford University. He has agreed very kindly to address himself to the issue and the challenge of corruption. He's already done so much work in that category, and we're very deeply grateful to you for joining us this morning to give us your thoughts. So a warm welcome to you.
Thank you. Corruption in the world of business can really be divided into two life forms. The first one is our companies that have tended to infect themselves. One or more officials in the company have done some illegal act, immoral act, or just terribly stupid act, and it's caused eventually the company to lose a lot of money or people lose a lot of money because of that act. The Enron era of cases typifies that life form. The other life form is our companies that have given a thing of value to someone outside the company to cause them to do an illegal, immoral, or terribly stupid act, which eventually, in so many cases, causes great losses to the company. In the middle 1970s, we had several hundred American companies embarrassed to disclose they'd made questionable payments to foreign officials. The other thing about corruption in the business world is that at least it seems to come in spurts, like this recent spurt of backdating options. 160 American companies have now admitted they backdated options, which we've now come to believe is not a good thing to do. I'm going to talk to you about four spurts that have come to us over the years. And if you don't mind, I'll indulge myself by doing it by reminiscing about how I got caught up in those spurts from time to time. And the theme here that I'd like to convince you of this theme, and that is that in every situation where you see a pattern of a lot of people doing the same thing and a lot of things that are wrong, there's a pattern of a lot of people doing the same thing wrong, there's usually some sort of influence around that's causing it or exacerbating it. I like to call them corrupting influences. And it's interesting as we go through the history of business corruption of how the world reacts to the problem. How it deals with the problem. Sometimes it just simply says, let's pass a law and stop doing it. I think at more intelligent times, they say, what's influencing this to happen? And they act to reduce that influence. In reminiscing, I have to tell you about 40 years of serving in what might be called the trenches of corporate warfare. Sometimes as chairman of a company, sometimes as a teacher, once as a plaintiff, more times as a defendant than I'd like to admit. A few years, of course, as a regulator. and lots of times as a director, as Eric said, 25 times as a director in 40 years, 14 or 15 audit committees, 10 times as chairman. In that period of time, about a dozen train wrecks, corporate train wrecks, Republic Pictures, Sunbeam Auster, Mayflower Van Lines, Drexel Burnham, Waste Management, name a few. Now, most of the crashes occurred before I got there, but I confess that I had a couple surprises along the way. My first kind of serious train wreck was in the period called the conglomerate craze in the 1960s. It became fashionable for managers to buy all kinds of companies and cram them together. Didn't make much difference whether they had any relationship to each other. The idea was that somehow the bunch of companies together would be better off and be worth more than the companies apart. It worked pretty well for Warren Buffett, but it hasn't worked a whole lot well for a lot of other people. It occurred for a couple of reasons. One reason was that management consultants said you could get synergies somehow. The other reason it happened is because there were accounting rules that were very lax. It was also coupled with what's called the roll-up strategy. The roll-up strategy is that if you're just a sleepy company and you go out and buy a couple companies, somebody on Wall Street says, well, you're a growth company, and so your price-earnings ratio goes from 5 times earnings to 7 to 10 to 12. And once your earnings get up to, say, 10, 15 times earnings, you can go out and buy another company for 5 times its earnings, automatically double the value of those earnings by incorporating into your earnings. My own problem was Republic Pictures. My predecessor had sold the movie stages and the movie library and gone out and bought 150 companies, a little more than that, actually, in a period of less than 2 years. And every time he bought a few companies, of course, the price-earnings ratio went way up. He was selling at 20 times earnings at one time. At 20 times earnings, he could buy almost anything he wanted to buy, a rug factory in Georgia, a company making roof bolts for coal mines, a guy that printed Buick spotter books someplace else, or overhauling the airplane engine someplace else. And when the companies didn't do so well, he took a bunch of them and sold them to a friendly company in exchange for stock in the friendly company, which he valued at a profit, so he kept making profits. Well, of course, it all came crashing down. Mm-hmm. It became a bloody mess. Stock went from $80 to a quarter on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, the accounting world, nobody went to jail for that. They all just lost their money, lost lots of money. It was thought to be stupid, but not terribly crooked. And they changed the accounting rules a little bit so that you have to value companies you buy that way a little better. We still get roll-up strategies. They still crater sometimes. But the terrible ugliness of the conglomerate craze passed. The next spurt that in which I got caught up in was during my years at the SEC. There were literally hundreds of American companies that confessed to giving what we called euphemistically a questionable payment to a foreign official. Some of them were quite vulgar. Lockheed gave over $20 million to the Prime Minister of Japan. Others were pretty understandable. DuPont had quite a lot of goods on a dock in Africa. I think it was well over $1 million. And the harbor master insisted upon getting a tip to get that stuff out. And I think the tip was in the neighborhood of $15,000, $20,000. Well, almost anybody would say, well, I'm going to give the guy $15,000, $20,000 to get our stuff back. The common feature of all these questionable payments was that they were made from secret bank accounts. It was quite common back in the 70s for companies to have those secret bank accounts off the books, kind of a petty cash account for the CEO. Most of them that we found had several $1 million in them. And from what we could tell, most of them were okay. I mean, let me say it differently. They were handled all right. It was a convenience. The CEO could write a check. Almost invariably, he would report back to the auditors what the check was for, and everything was accounted for. But, of course, the temptation of having all that money at your disposal with no accountability was a great temptation. So if a campaign contributor came along or a fundraiser for Nixon and you were the CEO of American Airlines, why not give them $500,000 out of a secret bank account? You could get influence and nobody would ever know the difference. And, of course, when you found you want to do business overseas and you had one of those little bank accounts, you could throw some money at somebody and wouldn't be caught. And, of course, ultimately, a whole lot of people just took some money home with them when they left. What we thought was that we had to eliminate the secret bank accounts. And so we did three things. First of all, we required internal controls. As late as 1975, corporations were not required to have internal controls. Second, we asked the auditors if they wouldn't please look very carefully at the books And if they saw something suspicious on the books, would they please call it the attention of somebody who was beyond suspicion? In those days, if the auditor saw an account of $10 million and it wasn't clear where the money went, he would ask the chief accounting officer or somebody else, you guys know about that? He'd say, yeah, if you check it out, it's okay. Well, then we had to find somebody independent of the suspicion. So we went to the New York Stock Exchange, and I don't think we threatened them, but I think we persuaded them that they would require outside audit committees for the first time. And so all of a sudden we had a capacity to get rid of, you know, secret bank accounts. And I think that worked. We did get rid of secret bank accounts. Hard to keep it secret. And we thought transparency, which would require accountability, would deal with it. Congress came along a couple years later and passed the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Excuse me. Basically making it a crime to do those sort of things. My mind has always been ambivalent about the law. that wide range of action between the DuPont dock tip and the Lockheed bribe to the Prime Minister of Japan, in between, there's all kinds of varieties of conduct. So we thought that handling it the way we did was probably okay. And I'm not saying that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is bad, but I'm not sure that it had anything to do with eliminating secret bank accounts. The next spurt, of course, is Enron, the Enron cases. That's a little more difficult thing to talk about. My own problem was waste management. We wrote off about $3.5 billion of assets that had been brought into income improperly, with the approval of the auditors, I might say. What was happening in those days is the management would take a look at the balance sheet, and they'd see that they didn't have they'd look, first of all, at their projection of earnings. They would see they weren't going to make Wall Street estimates, and then they'd look at their assets, and they'd say, well, let's take a look at those big storage containers you see in the street. What are they? What life do we have them? How often do we depreciate them? How long? And somebody'd say, well, we depreciate them over 15 years. And he'd say, well, couldn't they last 20 years? So they'd make it 20 years, and then they'd say, well, what is the salvage value? And they said in those days, well, we don't have any salvage value. We just sell them. We get done. We don't have them on the books. Well, they must be worth something. So we'll put them down as worth 25% of what we paid for them. Well, hell, that was $200 or $300 million of earnings just that year alone. What was wrong in that period was that our financial system, which was started in 1933 and 34 with the Securities Act, had gotten old, creaky. It needed a major overhaul. It was more than 70 years old, and as you can see, almost anything over 70 years of age gets pretty creaky. The financial statement itself had become obsolete. It was created in the days of bricks and mortar, when everything was tangible. If this table cost $500, and management said, well, I think it'll last 20 years, and the table is 4 years old, the auditors can pretty easily attest to the fact that that table is worth $1,000 less 5 years and attest to it on the balance sheet. And that works pretty well. But when you come to the age of information, as we have today, when so many assets are intangible and so many people want current market value, not historical value, you have the problem. Excuse me, I've got a latent cold here. Of the judgment needed to make that valuation. And management uses estimates and assumptions in making that judgment. And the auditors have this huge range of alternatives in which the management picks a number, and the auditors have to sit back and say, wow, well, that looks okay to me. And you can see that depending upon how fragile the auditor may think its relationship is, he may be pushed one way or the other. The other part problem was the external audit. Over the years, I would tell you that most managers have seen the external audit as a commodity, not having any real intrinsic value. And as a result, it became a compliance tax and not a management tool. With an external audit that is rule checking and a financial statement that is subject to such ambiguity, it gave too much leeway for people that wanted to push the envelope. The Economist magazine a couple years ago wrote a wonderful article called Hard and Fast is Not Fair and True. And they have this wonderful comment in it which says, you've got to stop relying upon the precision of financial statements because continuing to rely upon the brittle illusion of accounting exactitude puts you in the position of collapse in periods of economic strain. And that, in my mind, explains Enron. The periods of economic strain, the brittle illusion of accounting exactitude collapses, and you people see that it's not there. The fourth period we're in now, I should have said that my own train wreck there was waste management, as I mentioned earlier. What have we done about that? Sarbanes-Oxley is all we've done about it. It did one thing. It really put the onus on the audit committees that we created back in 1975 to take responsibility for the audit. In the ensuing years, from 1975 and for the next 25 years, too many audit committees thought that their highest goal in life was to reduce the cost of the audit. And while they were good to keep secret bank accounts out of the way, they didn't take charge of the audit, and they didn't protect the external auditor from the kind of pressures that management could give them. I was asked by Senator Sarbanes what evidence I had of that, and I said, well, all I know is that I've never been taken out for lunch by the external auditor, and the chief financial officer always is. As a result, Sarbanes-Oxley has essentially, in one of its more important points, says, if the auditors see that there were alternatives open to management that could produce a materially different result, they've got to make that clear to the auditor, to the external audit committee, the independent audit committee. And the audit committee and the auditors have to attest to the fact that the alternative chosen by management is fair. Now, I must say to you, that's how I interpret the act. A lot of people interpret that way. Some don't. But apart from that, the Sarbanes-Oxley doesn't do much about the ambiguity of financial statements. And so we're left with that problem until somebody gets around to restructuring those. The fourth area is the one we talked about briefly before, and that's the backdating of options. Actually, I caught up on that. I told Eric a minute ago that I've served on the board of a company for about 8 months. And during that time, it became clear to me that management wasn't the kind of management you want to be associated with. And I left. But anyway, they apparently had done some backdating of options before I got there and after I left. And so I'm caught up in a defendant in a lawsuit, one of those times I've been sued more times than I'd like to remember. Why? My theory, and I don't have any empirical evidence to prove this, my theory is pretty simple, and that is that until recently, options were not expensed. There was nothing, you didn't put anything on the balance sheet. You can give them away like grass. They had no value. So I give you 200,000 or 300,000 options, but nothing on the balance sheet. Well, when you tend to treat something as not worth anything, even though it clearly was an eventual cost of the company, you get careless with it. And so my theory is that that because we did not account for options for such a long time, management was careless in how they dated them. And it is not coincidental, I think, that we begin finding this out now that auditors have to look at the audits. They now have to expense them. And therefore, the auditors have to say, well, when were they given and what were they cost? And so that's, it seems to me, is why we've begun discovering those. Well, that's 40 years of business corruption from one perspective. And I would say to you that if you look back over the years of what we've done about them, I think the most important thing is to look for the corrupting influence and try to reduce it. I'm not saying you shouldn't say things are wrong and outlaw them, but if you don't get rid of that influence, or at least reduce it, the instinct for corruption, the incentive to do something wrong, is going to remain. I said at the outset, you know, illegal, immoral, or terribly stupid acts. If you talk about corporate governance, you really want to talk about all three things, because the whole idea here is to have our business world act intelligently. That's it, and we're open to broad discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I know that there'll be questions and reactions, but let me preempt by using Chairman's prerogative here. If we think about the international dimension and some of these spurts that you've mentioned and all the issues that you've highlighted here, to what extent would you assess the level of codification in terms of defining bridges on corporate governance systems and finding pathways to deal with the issue of addressing corruption through the OECD framework, through the other regional development banks and other modalities? How far along are we, and what do you think the challenges are in front of us?
Well, I think, you know, we've done Transparency International, OECD, all have done a tremendous job in identifying conduct that they would like people to follow. We have rules that are important. But as I guess I indicated, saying you shouldn't do something doesn't cause people to stop doing it. And the real issue is transparency, accountability, and enforceability. So in the center we have here at CSIS, what we emphasize is looking for the influence, the corrupting influence, trying to figure out what it costs, and then trying to design a way to get rid of it. Not easy. I mean, it's a tough issue. But as I say, as long as that influence is there, as long as the effort, as long as there's a temptation to do something that ought not really be done, people are going to accept the temptation. I've told the story before of leaving the White House as a counsel to the president and dealing with regulatory reform. We wanted the SEC to unfix commission rates to make the market more efficient. In those days, whether you bought 100 shares or a million shares, you paid the same per share cost. And the SEC did unfix commission rates, and the market became a lot more efficient. But to everyone's surprise, we eliminated a whole bunch of corruption. The stockbrokers were bribing the fund managers. They couldn't compete on price, so it was dinners in New York or dinners in Paris or some other thing of value. But just by total accident, we found out that a whole lot of corruption cases disappeared. What was interesting about that, it was a bitter fights on Wall Street about whether we should deregulate or not. Nobody ever mentioned the corruption angle.
One or two of these points are also mentioned in the context of the article that was distributed to you in the packet from the World Bank Institute to Development Outreach entitled Business as a Partner in Fighting Corruption. I'd certainly refer you to this article for some very interesting additional thoughts. Let's open things up, if we may. Who would like to begin? Christina?
Well, first of all, I use the word corruption much more loosely than most people. To me, it's anything that causes a behavior that most objective observers would not like to have happen. And so the question of legality or illegality to me isn't the driving factor. Transparency is by far the greatest issue, because if people are willing to have everybody know what you're doing, you tend to conform to a common standard. And I would say to you that there's no such thing as a corrupt culture. It's the circumstances. I mentioned in this article that the idea that some countries are more corrupt than others is, to me, is odious to say that. If you have a minister in Indonesia with complete discretion and no accountability, he is no more likely to be corrupt than a minister in Washington who has the same kind of. You see all kinds of people being corrupted in this convicted the United States here. I think there's a story in the paper today that more than 800 public officials were indicted last year throughout the country by the FBI. Yeah. So the issue is the system. Rule of law is a great idea. Rule of law, more than democracy in many respects, is a great idea. Rule of law, transparency, wherever you are.
Other questions, comments? Please.
But don't you think, I mean, I understand your point that whenever you have the temptation, people will continue to do it, and just saying it's wrong is not enough. But doesn't the risk of actually getting caught and prosecuted and then thrown in jail or whatever it may be, doesn't that create a disincentive and a deterrent that hopefully would happen?
Well, I hedged my words. I said I wasn't sure. The problem is here. First of all, the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act didn't get rid of secret bank accounts, and I'm not sure it would have by itself. Second, by criminalizing all that conduct, you've created an incentive to hide rather than an incentive to disclose. And I've suffered it over the years. So as something has to be done. And the question is, does it fit within the definition of a facility name payment in the Foreign Corrupt Practice Act? Or if we make that facilitating payment, is it too much? I think we've always answered that correctly, but it's a problem. If it were a strong civil law, I would have no problem with it at all. If the criminality of it could be reduced to those areas where it was obviously venal, I wouldn't have so much problem with it. And it has been amended, as you know, so it has less of that effect than it had in its inception. And so I can't really answer your question. All I can say is that it has an adverse effect by criminalizing this whole wide range of conduct. I was at a forum not so long ago when a whole bunch of very famous former attorneys general and CEOs were asked a number of questions. And one of them was, you were asked $10,000 to get that equipment off the dock. Would you do it? And two of the former attorneys general said, oh, that's too much for a facilitating payment. We can't do it. And so it really does have that ambiguity in it. But let me say, I keep my hedge there. I can't say it's not a good thing. And it does have some advantage, public relations-wise, in the world, that people say, well, Americans can't do that sort of thing. I will say, though, that business can be pretty clever. And there's lots of ways to find something of value to be involved. A lot of people build schools and monuments in the honor of some government official. Is that a bribe? I've seen cases in which problems with the government have been turned over to a lawyer with a contingent fee. And if the lawyer is able to get something from the government of X dollars, he can get 30% of it. That may be $1 million or so to get that. And what happens to that contingent fee? It's a difficult problem. Yes, sir.
There are a number of countries around the world that are already, notorious for the depth of corruption and. In that society, what if you were given the assignment and agreed to take it, to pick one of those, and turn it around, give us a sort of a, what's the model that you would use to do it?
Well, we are engaged right now in an exploratory effort in Kenya to see if it makes sense to put a governance center there, and to. Had to look at it. I don't know that there is a model. I know that a way to approach it. There's a book written recently by Professor Johnston at Colgate called Syndromes of Corruption. And he makes a point that says, on the one hand, if you're going to deal with corruption in a country like the United States, Germany, or Japan, you realize those are elite countries. And you got to tackle the problem at the intersection between the legislative body and the interests that would like to influence that legislative body. That's where you go, and that's where you have to work on the problem. There are a lot of countries, he says, like the Philippines, Mexico, where oligarchs and clans are there. And if you want to reform those countries, you got to reform the oligarchs and clans. It may not be nice, you don't like to do it. If you want to, you can shoot them, but you won't get reform, you'll get anarchy. And so in a place like the Philippines, we're beginning to go there with Michael Johnson, I might say, to try to see how best to move the oligarchs and clans. Where can you find a way to find a reform effort that isn't so threatening to them that they're willing to break from past and move? A good example are in Romania and Russia, where you had terribly corrupt tax systems for a long time. And you have that in the Philippines, terribly corrupt tax system. In Romania and Russia, and one of the Baltic countries, you went to a flat tax. And the flat tax, first of all, people paid the flat tax. And it was very difficult to be corrupt because everybody paid the same amount. And so one of the ways we're experimenting is to put on displays in the Philippines of what happened in Romania and Russia in the hope that that will not be so threatening to the oligarchs and clans. They might say, well, let's see if we can't escape. If we can get the system changed fast enough, maybe we won't have to go to jail. So I mean, that's a kind of a crude example, but that's the type of thing I think you have to do. You have to understand what the influence is. The tax system that's so staggered that some people just feel they can't pay it, they won't pay it, to move it to a system that people will pay. But it's a diagnostic. It is trying to figure out what to be done. One of the things we've tried to do in the program is to make academic institutions realize that they're not really doing anything about the subject of corruption. They're serious. I mean, they have ethics courses, which I don't mean to denigrate ethics courses, but it doesn't really help you understand the problems. And our theme is that we think sociology, political science, economics are at least as important as law in trying to understand corruption, trying to make people understand that. And we have a wonderful academic council that have taught courses of various types. And I had this great idea of bringing them all together and bringing in some university presidents to hear them. And I thought I could cause these university presidents to say, we've got to have all these courses. My friend Michael Johnson said, no, you misunderstand the problem, Rod. We don't know what to teach. We don't have enough information. What we need to do is do more research on the type of corruption, how to get at the so-called corrupt influences move them. So we had a different conference. We had all these professors come together and talk about what research they had done, what research they thought needed to be done, and most important, how to use that research to affect public policy. That doesn't really answer your question, but that's the course we're on.
If you'll permit me, I'd like to ask a follow-up question. You mentioned a three-step process, which I believe is persuasive and evident. Identify sources of corruption, identify opportunity cost of those practices, and then formulate or fashion a strategy to address them. Now, it strikes me in thinking about the long span that you've described here this morning, how far the politics and the social conditions with respect to corruption have evolved. I can remember not long ago when college textbooks looked at corruption as a grease of development. In fact, I think that Sam Huntington in some of his seminal early works referred to it in that way. We've seen remarkable evolution with respect to how to identify and classify corruption. From the standpoint of economics, is anyone now doing broader aggregate opportunity cost analysis of what corruption, what kind of a drag corruption is on economic growth?
Well, I think there's been a lot of work, yes. I can't spit it out. Michael Johnston's book has a good bibliography in it.
Yeah.
And the people we had at the Wharton, we have at this conference at Wharton, if you look at their resumes, I mean, my Lord, some of them had 14 or 15 pages of articles and things they'd written.
Yes.
There's an enormous amount of work done. It's interesting that that work is not clearly tied up with policy makers. That's it. And so there's a lot to be done.
I don't know if we have anyone from the World Bank here today, but they've done interesting work at the bank in terms of assessing the opportunity cost of regulatory frameworks. They've done a report over the past two or three years called Doing Business, in which they've looked at regulatory drag on economies, expressing that as percentage of GDP opportunity cost equivalent. And it would be interesting to do something like this on corruption as well.
Well, there has been work done. I just can't cite a lot.
Fair enough.
Question.
Good.
I was just going to follow on this other aspect of this. One
potential way to address it, which I've seen in action in two companies, is to have the general counsel and a special team put together a package, a Q&A, you know, questions, answers. I mean, you have to answer what would you do if, and the whole company gets trained. It's a 4 or 5 hour process at a minimum, and then there's a feedback process. People come through and meet the deputy DGs if there, you know, there are real questions there. So the company is, you know, at least working from one template, and there's still going to be temptation, and there may still be mistakes, but it struck me as being, you know, relatively effective. Do you think that
we have it. I'm chairman of the audit committee of Chiquita International, which does business in a lot of interesting places. And we have a computer program that every manager and every director has to pass every year. And it throws questions at you. They give you a hypothetical situation, it throws questions at you, and you got to answer them. And every once in a while you get a big loud buzzer that says, and you got to start all over again.
Report to General Council.
So there's there are literally some terrific things to in terms of training. Let me make this point. The world economy that started in Venice in about the early 15th century steadily grew over the next 600 years and went from Italy to Netherlands to England, probably to here now. And that world economy 15 years ago or 16 years ago, something like that, was about 600, 700 million people from Western Europe, United States, and Japan. And that group of companies, the countries, basically came to the level of how to do business. Most of them were free and open companies, countries. Most of them had rule of law. And in these last years, that world economy has had a huge shock because a couple, 3 billion other people have opened themselves up to business, to trade. And that was a constrained economy where there was not rule of law, where there was a lot of rule by dictate, rule of law, rule of men, not rule of law. And trying to get one society to adjust to the other is one of the reasons why this is such an important issue right now for business, because business goes into that society and faces what was necessary in those societies. You had to bribe somebody to get your husband out of jail, to get your dog back, to keep your business going. And so people were subject to so much corruption pressure, that to try to get away from that and move it out is a tough issue. And that's why I think that the effort to understand those corrupted influences, get rid of them, as somebody said, the regulatory requirements. You know, in some countries where it takes 6 months to get a business license, whereas in Singapore it takes 2 days. You know there's corruption in one place and not the other place. There's a question over here someplace.
Yeah. Carl Varner. In the hedge funds area, the attempt to regulate and increase transparency, what do you think about that versus the burden of regulatory?
That's a hard area. A hedge fund is, in fact, nothing more than a whole lot of money controlled by a small group of people that invest that money. And there have been efforts to register them. I'm an agnostic again. I don't think there's a call for a wholesale regulation of hedge funds, but I do understand that there's a lot of uncertainty about how they act. And so I've suggested to Chris Cox and others that what might be sensible here is to have a congressional finding requiring the control of the currency or the Federal Reserve Board or some financial institution look at them as a broad area and give them some authority to go into the records of some companies. I think a whole lot of hedge funds would cooperate in that kind of investigation. And there may be something, there may be some area that you need to deal with, but insider trading, there's no kind of regulation that will increase hedge funds, like everybody else, are subject to insider trading. And so the question is, what will you accomplish by regulation? What are you trying to stop? You really need to find out what you're trying to stop happening before you start regulating. So I'm all for some kind of transparency, but I don't really know. I'm agnostic about exactly how to do it. I do think a well-structured commission with the funding to do this would make a whole lot of sense. Take any venture capital fund. Look at all these huge funds that Blackstone and Apollo have, billions of dollars. You can make the same argument about them, that anybody with that much money should have some kind of transparency they don't have. So picking the hedge funds out of that pack doesn't seem to me make a lot of sense, but I do grant you that that's dangerous. The big problem with hedge funds is to what extent are banks or other financial institutions that are critical to our economy in danger because they don't understand the risks that they've taken. And so far, we've seen no sign of it. Something like 63 hedge funds collapsed last year, and it was barely a ripple in our society. So the question of whether there is a systemic risk to our economy, I don't think, it seems to me there's no evidence that there is. Jim? There's two questions there. You pick them.
I think he was first.
Mr. Hills, I'm wondering your thoughts on the future of corporate reform in America and whether or not Sarbanes-Oxley has laid a firm foundation for that. An argument I've heard is that CEOs and board of directors spend more time worrying about auditing than they are about developing innovative strategies and expanding growth of their corporations. And I remember coming across a statistic where I believe in 2005, class action lawsuits against corporations totaled $10 billion versus I think it was $150 million in 1997. So I'm wondering if Sarbanes-Oxley, particularly Section 404, is more corporate overkill than anything else.
Well, if you read Section 404, it's pretty benign. It says you've got to have internal controls and you've got to verify they work. The issue is the implementation. And I don't think that there's a whole lot of disagreement among those people that are suffer from it, if you will, that some auditing firms over-egged the issue, asked for verification of more things than they needed to ask for. I don't think there's much disagreement that PCOAB, field inspectors, pushed auditors to do more than they really had to push them to do. So we've gone through an adjustment period, and obviously both the SEC and the PCAOB are trying to find some way to lower the burden on smaller companies. But I would tell you that from my experience and the experience of most larger companies, it's coming out okay. At my company, Chiquita, and let's say Chevron as an example, which I understand, what we've taken is the 404 process and made sure that it's become a management tool so the information is useful in running the company, and trying to shove that into the external audit and try to make more of a management tool out of the external audit, which, as I said earlier, is too much of a compliance tax. So my view is that the 404 process is adjusting itself, that long before Secretary Paulson talked about this, the PCOAB and the SEC were working to straighten that out. And I know that I've been there a number of times arguing for things they were doing they didn't have to do. In the broader area, Sarbanes-Oxley isn't much more than a far more effective effort to accomplish the same things we tried to do back in 1975. The audit committees we created back then are now under rule of law, if you will. They've got to take charge of the audit. I don't think that's a problem. I think a problem is, there's two problems here that you've tapped on. One is the members of the boards of directors who have been a little bit sleepy about taking control of the audit and maybe a little sleepy about the job they should do on the compensation committee are all of a sudden becoming more active in those two areas. And there's a real danger that directors are going to try to be just as active in the company's strategies and say, all right, we want to tinker with the strategy as well as tinkering with the audit. And I think that is kind of a danger, and I think that's caused some problems. I don't say that directors shouldn't understand the strategies, but a director who has a good financial background is quite useful in trying to make sure the audit works, and a director who's had lots of experience with compensation matters is just as good as the company in trying to deal with the compensation of the top officers. But you cannot expect a board of directors to create company strategies. Litigation front is a much more difficult area, particularly in the relationship of the financial statements. If you have a financial statement that is clearly not precise as it's supposed to be, if you have auditors that test you to numbers that they really can't attest to, then you have a society where almost any jury in Jackson, Mississippi can say the auditors were wrong. And that's a real danger. Now, what's happened over the years is that because the auditors are nervous about that, they run to FASB, the Financial Accounting Standards Board, and tried to get a rule to say, well, we have this new kind of revenue recognition. Can we recognize it or not? And so FASB nicely writes a rule. Well, somebody once said from the NYU accounting department, it takes FASB 4 years to write a rule and Wall Street 4 minutes to get around it. And so you have a society in which it came to be thought that if it wasn't forbidden, it could be done. And in the Enron case, what you really had is a maze of rules, and you have very clever businessmen, management consultants, lawyers who could wend their way through that maze and create a thing that seemed to comply with the letter of the rule, but not the spirit. It got worse than that. You know, the financial statement that auditors sign off on says, it is our opinion that the financial statement prepared by management fairly presents the financial condition of the company in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. Well, it became convenient for lawyers, good lawyers, to say, well, if it's in accordance with GAAP, it's fair. It's hard to figure that out from the standpoint of a good English teacher, but in effect, Enron is that case. It's hard to find where Enron violated GAAP, but you sure as hell can say it's not fair, and all that debt concealed from the average investor. So what Sarbanes-Oxley really has done is said you can't do that anymore. It's got to be fair, and you've got to take account for it. But by saying it's got to be fair, just the example I gave you a minute ago, you have this wide range. You could say easily, well, this one's fair, and so is this one. And so if we don't have mirrors telling us which is the fairest of all, juries in Mississippi might try to say which is the fairest. So you've got to protect business and auditors from that kind of lawsuit. It can be done. The SEC can give a safe harbor. It's politically not feasible right now, even though the SEC can do it. So somehow, working with the PCAOB and the SEC to create a safe harbor so that if the PCAOB and the SEC sees nothing to sue, then the third parties, it seems to me, should not be allowed to sue. If the SEC looks into it and sues, okay, then let anybody else sue. But I think you need something like that. Whether that's enough or not, I can't tell you, but that's a way to reduce some of the litigation risk. It is very high today, very high. And what the danger is, you know, if you go to court and you can sue Ernst & Young for $2 billion for a matter, you can get to a jury that might give a $2 billion award. Well, you can't afford a $2 billion. You can't afford that chance. So you settle for $50 million. So whether or not you want to put a cap on the amount of litigation or you want to take the approach I'm suggesting, we need to do something.
We had another.
Hi, John Sullivan. Thanks for a terrific overview of that period in a very concise way.
You can see the scars, can't you?
Yes, they're very visible. Related to the last question, you know, but to put it into a global context, what you've described is a fair amount of complexity. And whether SOX has driven us in the right direction or not, when you compare it with the European exchanges and then even more so with Hong Kong, let's say, or other exchanges, there is a growing feeling that we're getting a lot of divergence in business practices, in fear, which you just described, and also in the underlying philosophy of fairly precise regulatory bright lines versus general principles-based approach, although I think you can take the last part of that too far when you talk about Europe. But do you see a fear that the American capital markets are going to suffer, that we're going so far on investor protection and disclosure and transparency, all of these good things, that the end result could be our capital markets will not be competitive with others?
That's a terribly important question. I'm not sure anybody can answer it with complete precision. Let me make a couple observations. First one is that we still get a premium in our markets. A stock that trades on our exchanges gets a better price-earnings ratio than any place else in the world. And some of that has to be due to the confidence in the integrity of the financial statement. Second, if you take Western Europe, if you go to the beginning of my 40-year sojourn in the trenches, you'd say that Europe was a debt-based economy. It was not an equity-based economy. The companies lived on debt. There was no effective equity markets, capital equity markets in the capital markets. In the last 10, 15 years, Germany and France, Italy, others have become more equity-based. There are many, many more public issues in Europe of equity than there were in past years. So it's understandable that the European markets are getting a larger percentage of the world IPOs than they used to get because there are more European IPOs. Same is true in China. Look at all the companies that are going public in China. Well, obviously you take the Hong Kong Stock Exchange or the Shanghai Stock Exchange because there's so much savings in that part of the world. That's a much easier place to raise money. I don't think that has any real danger. I've spent some time this last few months with Chairman Zhang of China Netcom, which is a multi-billion-dollar telecom company in China, significantly owned by the Chinese government but traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Chairman Zhang is doing everything he can to prove that his rules of corporate governance are good and that's where he wants to be listed. And if you go to China, you see a lot of people would like to move to our exchanges. Now, having said that, the fact is that the litigation risks we have right now are serious. They are serious. And we do need to as you say, move to more of a principle-based society. As you know, the International Accounting Standards Board, Sir David Tweedy and Bob Hertz of the Financial Accounting Standards Board, are trying to reconcile the two approaches. And the first thing you have to say is, well, the difference between rules and principles is kind of silly because all rules have principles and all principles have rules. What we're really talking about is having fewer of them and relying more on judgment. And that's just the test, more on judgment, fewer rules. And how do you protect the judgment from unwarranted litigation? I mean, that's really where we are. And I think that we do need to solve that problem. And if we don't solve it, I do think you're right. There could be a problem.
Last question, please, Margaret.
Well, thanks, Rod.
It's on?
Yes.
You're doing good. It's fine, Rankin. It's on.
Oh, it's on. Okay. Well, thanks for this wonderful presentation. I really enjoyed it. And having been an alumnus of the Hills Program on Governance, I just wanted to pick up on a point that you mentioned earlier. I think one of the most valuable things that the program has been able to establish so far is these case studies amongst the various countries where we have governance centers. And you mentioned an interesting example of using a case study from Romania and applying it to the Philippines. So it's not such an aggressive way to sort of provide an example of corruption in another country to see where there can be some lessons learned. Do you see the continuation of that sort of thing becoming the evolving mission of the program here at CSIS? And
well, I hope so, because that's what we're trying to
how
do.
How do you and what other goals do you envision for the program moving forward?
Well, as you may recall, one of the really kind of fun things we did last year, we opened up a center at Tsinghua University in China, and quite nervous about the question of Americans coming into China and telling them that they're corrupt, especially after the Enron era and all the rest of it. So, as you know, we did a case study, Yonsei University, where we have a program. Yonggi Kim, the director, had conducted a study of the collapse event of Daewoo, the huge Korean cheval, an accounting scandal twice as big as the Enron scandal. They did a wonderful job on it. So Yonggi Kim came down to Tsinghua and presented the Daewoo scandal to the Chinese. And they loved it. I mean, they because it was an example of an overreaching government in Asia that had pushed a private enterprise to do things they shouldn't have pushed them to do, and then said, okay, you're on your own. And out there on their own, they had to resort to financial maneuvering to stay afloat. Of course, it collapsed. And it was interesting. We had securities regulators from China watching it, and they enjoyed it. So I guess the point I made before is that there is no part of the world that doesn't have serious corruption problems. And we're never going to get rid of all of it. All we can do is try to find more efforts to understand the influences that cause it. And I thank you all for being here.
Well, let me simply say that it's unique to have someone with your insight and experience share his knowledge with a group like this. And we're deeply grateful for the time that you've taken today, and we're deeply grateful for the role that you're playing within CSIS and our Hills program on governance. And thank you so very much.
You're very
appreciate
welcome.
It. Thank you. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.